This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 3 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And Max isn't here today. He's on an away mission. We will see if he returns. Depends on what color shirt that he's wearing.
Yeah. I told him gold. Wear gold.
We'll see if he listens, but he should be back next week. We are going to be discussing Jerry Taylor's first producing credit. This is part two in our series on Jerry Taylor. And that producing credit, writing producing credit, we wanted to look at you know, her work as a writer, but we didn't want to just do every single one-off thing that she did. So we figure you look at, you know, her work as a writing producer,
right,
and then you hit all the big key shows. So we're going to look at her work as a writing producer on Quincy ME, a show which was created by Glenn A. Larson and Lou Shaw, and starring Jack Klugman. It ran for 8 seasons, although it looks like it was really only 7 seasons, but they split the first season up into like 2 halves, but whatever. Technically 8 seasons.
Technically, yeah.
Over 7 years, I guess. And she came on in season 5 as a writer. She had only been writing for television for about a year prior to this, and she had just done a couple of one-off episodes on various TV shows, which no one's ever heard of. And then this seemed to be kind of her regular gig, although she had done a number of freelance things during this time period on shows like Little House on the Prairie and Incredible Hulk and some other things. She had written a few after-school specials and TV movies. And this was the show which she had done more work on than anything else up until this point. She was a writer starting on season 5, and then during season 8, which was the last season of the show, she became a producer as well. And it seems like she had a pretty big influence on the show on the whole, because she had written a lot of key episodes during this season. But yeah, before we get into her specific work, maybe we should just talk about Quincy ME.
Oh, gladly.
As a series. Now, I had never seen this show up until this point. I had always been aware of it, but I've never actually watched it. I take it you were aware of it?
I was aware of it. I was not its target demographic, but some people in my house were. And I know that my grandfather watched it for at least a couple of years, because I remember the opening, and I remember being disoriented enough to think, why is Oscar Madison? Where's Felix? What's going on right now? So, you know, I was very aware of television at an early age. Like, going back and seeing it now, it still evokes that same sort of like warm, fuzzy feeling. It's like sitting in grandpa's room and it's like, hey, I'm watching TV with grandpa, you know? And it's like, what's going on?
Yeah, I get the same impression, actually, even though I had never seen it. Maybe it's just because of that time period or whatever, mm-hmm, or knowing, you know, my grandparents. Like, I kept on thinking, like, this is, I guarantee you, my grandparents watched show, you know?
Yeah.
My grandmother, being a huge Murder, She Wrote fan, seems like this would be right up her alley. And the music and everything, you know, it just feels like something from that era, you know?
Yeah, oh, it's definitely of its time. And there are so many things going back and, you know, watching these episodes, and also, you know, going back and sort of like refamiliarizing myself with it, you know, and catching snippets of the other ones, you know, cause, you know, so long as they're there streaming, why not, you know, take a couple of pieces out of it. And like, it definitely belongs to that era. There are so many TV tropes from that time period that are like, it hits all of the notes. You need this, and you need this, and you need this, and this is what makes a successful teleplay. And yeah, it just, it goes by those numbers, and, you know, obviously audiences enjoyed it. If it's, you know, it's got 8 seasons, that's a pretty good run.
To me, what I did prior to watching the Jerry Taylor episodes was I watched the pilot because I was like, I want a good baseline for what this show is, and that's kind of what pilots are designed to do. And as I was watching it, you know, like the plot of the pilot is basically like there's an investigation into a crime, and it seems to be an open and shut case, and Quincy doesn't think that it is, and he, you know, says, "Hey, guys, come on, look at this evidence here," and the cops are like, "Quincy, you don't know what you're talking about. This doesn't make any sense. You know, the simplest solution is usually the correct one." And he's like, "No, no, look at this." And the whole time I kept on thinking, like, this is kind of cool how this guy is doing his thing and using forensic medicine in order to solve a case. It's kind of weird that the cops aren't using him for, like, the reason why they have him. Like,
there seems to be a sense of, I think you hit it on the head there, where it's like, not just the pilot, but like moving forward, you learn to trust this guy's hunches too. You know, I'm telling you, this is what happened. It's like, maybe I'll go look into that. Maybe I won't drag my feet on things and listen to Quincy from time to time, because he seems to have a good head on his shoulders.
It's not even hunches. Sometimes it's flat out like, the science says that this happened. And they're like, "What are you talking about? No, we have an eyewitness." And it's like, dude. But I kind of, you know, watching that, and I don't know how most episodes of Quincy are, but I just kind of assumed that that would be how every episode was. You know, that it was like, you know, there's a crime, and it looks like this is what happened, and then he's going to use science in order to determine that something else happened, and he's going to stick it. You know, like this one, it had, like, he was in the middle of a gunfight at one point and all this stuff. He went down to Mexico, and his girlfriend got, like, pushed out of a moving car and ended up in the hospital.
It's pretty thrilling.
It is pretty thrilling, you know? And I'm like, this is great, and yet, and I can see how this would be fun to watch. But at the same time, I can't imagine watching this for 8 years nonstop.
You know, again, going back to the whole idea of being of its time, you know, I think that we all have lost perspective on, you had three choices. Yes. And it was, you were going to watch Quincy, or you were going to watch whatever was up against it on ABC or NBC and or CBS. Which network did this run on?
I want to say NBC because I know that most of the Glenn Larson shows were on NBC, but I honestly don't know.
Okay. Well, whichever one it was on, the other two were up against it. I mean, they didn't even have, you know, Fox at that time. So there was nothing. And yeah, so I'm sure that that helps a show. And, you know, somebody comes home, they want to watch something. You could have done worse back then.
Sure.
You really could have done worse.
Oh, yeah, it's totally watchable. And I guess in sort of the era when you don't have VCRs and stuff like that, and you don't have access to all of these episodes whenever you want them,
right?
It's like, if you want your Quincy fix, you kind of want a specific thing. And if you can't watch your favorite episode again and again and again, they're just going to make your favorite episode again and again and again and call it new.
Right.
And give you that.
Right. Well, it's just like sequels before the rise of being able to rewatch stuff. Like sequels, that's why they were cookie cutter. You know, you look at James Bond. Every James Bond movie, once they figured out the template, followed the same template. Like beat by beat, broken down the exact same way. And it's because, like you said, you couldn't call up your favorite, you know, your favorite episode at a whim. And, you know, let's say you go 2 weeks without seeing Quincy, you're not going to mind that something's a little repetitive about it, because you're there to watch Quincy do his thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
It was on NBC, by the way.
So okay.
For whatever that's worth.
I stand corrected then.
One last thing about Quincy on the whole. The opening title sequence, I think, is kind of amazing. It is very much of its time. It definitely has that 70s vibe where you've got, you know, like three boxes or circles with montages of Quincy in action and stuff like that. But the thing that is most intriguing about this to me, and I love like the beginning where they have, where he's like, gentlemen, you're going to enter the, you're about to enter the most interesting part about the police investigation or whatever it is. And forensic medicine. And then like he reveals the dead body and like two of them pass out instantly.
Right off
and
the
then
bat.
Like the third like keels over and starts puking and stuff like this. And it's like, that's great. But there's one thing in there, which, you know, when I'm watching it the first time, I'm like, oh, okay. But there's as part of the montage, you keep on cutting back to him in close-up looking intently at, like, a body.
Yep.
You know, where he's examining, like, an arm or something.
Yes.
And it keeps on cutting back to this in the montage. And then at the end, the big reveal is that he's studying, like, a woman's arm. And this woman is, like, lying on his boat, his trademark boat, I guess.
Yep.
And then he's like, here's some champagne. And then, like, he kisses her. And it's like, oh, he's a ladies' man, too. And, oh, look at that. It's a funny joke. You thought it was a dead body. But really, he was examining the female form or something.
Yes.
And I'm like, that's funny. And then when I watched the second episode, it happened again, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember, that's funny. And then by, like, the third or fourth time, you're like, they did this, like, literally, like, 148 times.
Yes.
I wonder at what point it got old, but good for them for sticking with this joke, because...
Not even changing, anything about it. It's definitely... A cute little short film of an opening, but even with being unable to call up the like at least the episodes themselves, even if they follow the same beats and everything, and it's him going around and doing his thing, the circumstances change. Whereas in the credits, it's just literally the same thing over and over again.
It's like even Dick Van Dyke by like season four learned to step around the ottoman instead of falling over it.
Right.
You know.
Right.
You'd think they would change it up a little bit, but I guess not. So good for them.
Yeah, you got to save money somehow.
So, looking at Jerry Taylor's work on the show, now we kind of skipped ahead and went straight to season 8, which was her final season. I don't know if you watched any of the episodes that she had done prior to that, but I didn't. Season 8 really did seem to be Taylor's arc. In a lot of ways. In the very first episode of the season, which was written by her, they introduce a new character to the show, which was the character of Dr. Emily Hanover, played by Anita Gillette. Now, this is a character who was a psychiatrist, and she's introduced in the first episode, Baby Rattlesnakes, and she becomes a love interest for Quincy. And she's basically in the entire season. There are 24 episodes in season 8, and she's in 17 of them, listed in the credits as a special guest star. So kind of like the Dr. Pulaski of Quincy and me, I guess.
Nice. Nice pull.
But not nearly as annoying, so that's good.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. Yeah.
So what did you think about this character?
I think you're right. Like, there's a... She's definitely a modern woman, and I'm not saying that in like a dismissive way. I'm saying that in the sense that when you're watching the show, the whole thing that makes the character attractive to Quincy and attractive to the audience is that she is that the female foil for Quincy. Like that, it makes sense that they pursue that sort of love story with her. They very obviously wrote her to fill that role. The time period then is when people were talking about the ERA and stuff like that. And you can definitely see a lot of the modern sensibilities being worked out of treating women more equally in a relationship, and sort of the topics that were going on at the time. And because she's a very authoritative character. She's a very knowledgeable character, and she provides a lot of information, a lot of exposition really, about the situations that she's in each episode. And, you know, she seems to be an endless fountain of knowledge about just about everything.
Yeah.
And so she's a natural companion for Quincy.
Yeah, it really is kind of interesting, especially in the way that they seem to be portraying the character, like in the opening sequence and in the first episode, even really, where it's like, oh, well, this is my girlfriend, but no, we're just friends. We're not, you know, serious and everything. And he's right. A bachelor, and he loves the bachelor life and everything like that. And in this season, they're like, we're going to give him, you know, we're going to introduce a woman who's the opposite of all that stuff. You know, she's not like just a disposable girlfriend type for him. She is, you know, really someone who can stand up to him on his terms. You know, right. She's not going to be sitting around waiting for him to do his job like the woman in the first episode is. He's going to be saying, hey, I need your help solving this case. And she's going to be like, nah, I don't want to do that.
Right.
But she does in one episode. And yeah. That's really cool. And I would bet anything that Taylor was responsible for this character. You know, the sure. fact that she wrote the first episode that she was in, she took a very active role in the show during the season where she was introduced and has her arc. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she's very similar to other Taylor characters that we see in things like Star Trek, you know? She's very sure. similar to Janeway in a lot of ways in that she's yeah. a scientist, you know, and all of these things. And it makes sense. So, yeah, I think that's pretty cool. And it really sort of shows Taylor putting her stamp on this show. You know, one of the things that I was kind of worried about in doing this was, like, these shows are so formulaic in general. Like, what aside from, you know, someone being maybe really good at procedurals, how do you see them stand out in particular? And even though I haven't seen any other Quincy ever, I can totally see Taylor in this stuff.
I'll skip all the way down to the end of season 8 and say that, you know, if we're looking for sort of her stamp and the creation of the strong female characters, the simple fact that she has basically a female dock worker in a very prominent appearance at the beginning of Cutting Edge, you know, palling around with the guys and, you know, again, it speaks to that whole idea of, you know, equal treatment. It doesn't matter that there's a woman working on the dock. She's just one of the friends that's there hanging out and congratulating the guy on the birth of his kid. It's just,
yeah,
she's just there.
Okay. So looking at, her episodes, first we've got Baby Rattlesnakes, which was the first episode of season 8, which introduces the character of Dr. Hanover. And it's about troubled kids, who have been in gangs and stuff like that, who have been in trouble with the law and are part of a program which essentially will give them a second chance to try to clean up their act. And it's sort of a case of a kid being framed by some other kids, and he's, you know, it looks like he's going to go to jail for murder, and then they, you know, try to help him out and get him out of the situation. The interesting thing to me about that is, in terms of like looking at it as far as Taylor's career is concerned, it's very similar to Star Trek in a lot of ways in that it's dealing with social issues of the time.
Yeah.
Which is something that we see repeatedly throughout this season, I think, or at least a couple times. Mm-hmm. What did you think about Baby Rattlesnakes?
Well, it's definitely social justice television, and mm-hmm. I don't have a specific lens other than a sense that opening an episode with a drive-by shooting was probably a little, I don't know, the risque for the time. Like, that was a little over the edge when you think about what was being shown. Now, it wasn't gory or bloody. It wasn't like watching, you know, Game of Thrones or anything like that. But you definitely got what was happening, and it immediately opens with, oh, you know, something that people were obviously concerned about, which was violence on the streets and gang membership and stuff like that. And I agree with you that in the Star Trek sense, it speaks to what's on everybody's mind in terms of like a, you know, a social ill, and also setting up her character as somebody with a conscience, but also playing off of the other characters and really highlighting all the different positions. You know, you have the heavy, you have the politician who is the heavy in the situation, and he wants to throw everybody away in jail because there's nobody to be, you know, and the, where the episode gets its title from, where he says, you know, baby rattlesnakes are just as poisonous as full-grown rattlesnakes.
Yes.
They belong in a cage. I think it's a really fascinating way to look at the way people thought about this issue back in the early 80s. I have a feeling, again, it's just a feeling, that this was pushing the envelope a little bit, and they probably sensed that they needed to try to find new ways to push forward with the show to try to avoid, you know, the axe at the end of the season.
Yeah.
So, because it's not like those sorts of things come out of nowhere. Obviously, the ratings indicated that they might not get continued, and so they just maybe they decided to start taking chances with that sort of thing.
That could be, yeah. That sort of idea of important issues of the time or whatever is made even more apparent in Taylor's second episode of the season, A Cry for Help. This was the teen suicide episode, which to me was problematic in the sense that it really, really played like they were just telling you everything there is to know about teen suicide and how big of a problem this was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, while that information is important to get out, this may not be the best format. Because like you're saying, with the character of Hanover, she really became just an exposition machine where all she did was say, like, do you realize that in the next 24 hours, 50 people will try to commit suicide, and 18 of those will be successful? Like, that's literally a line of dialogue in this episode.
Right. It's like she's reading right off of a press release from Suicide Prevention Hotline.
And at times, I feel like it does kind of dip into, like, Reefer Madness territory, where it's like...
Yeah.
Six kids have jumped off of this building, and there's probably even more that tried to kill themselves. Kids are killing themselves left and right. You know, I mean, like, I can understand teen suicide was an issue and still is an issue, of course, but it's not like, I mean, six kids in one high school or one college, like, I'm sorry. That seems to be just stretching it a little bit.
Yeah, it does. You mentioned like the format is sort of like an after school special at certain points, and this is the one that is the most like an after school special. You know, because it's you have the kid who is playing drums in his room all the time and locking the door. Like it's one of those things where it plays like that after school special where you sit there and you say, this is a really important issue. And I get that you're trying to communicate that. And I appreciate what you're trying to say. But at the same time, you're setting up so many easy signs for people. Like, why don't, like, maybe we could construct this in such a way where it, you can understand how difficult it is to see that somebody's having an issue as opposed to, and you know, and they have the father who flat out states at one point, you know, I have to blame this kid because otherwise it's my fault. So I'm never going to admit that anything else. And, and Klugman says, don't get so focused. Maybe your other kids are trying to say something to you.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, number one, that's not the greatest line. And number two, are you sure your bedside manner is working for a dad who just had his, this is not the best time to try, you know, tough love on this guy. You know, he's grieving.
And that seemed like most of what they were doing in this episode. Like, you know, there were no signs. Oh, yeah, there were signs, and you totally missed them. And it's like, well, thanks, Quincy. That's really helpful. You know, or Hanover, you're a psychiatrist. Well, what does saying that to a parent who just lost their kid do to their psyche, you know?
Right.
I mean, like, and it felt so shoehorned into this show. Like, there really isn't a place for this because they're like, well, Quincy, can you determine the cause of death? Well, yeah, she was shot, but was she shot by herself or shot by someone else? Well, let me do a psychiatric autopsy
right.
in order to determine. And then basically what she does is she goes around and does the police's job, as I see right. it, you know,
yes.
establishing
yes,
motive and stuff like that by saying, like, well, was this girl suicidal? Spoilers. Yes, she was. Okay.
Right.
So then it's my determination as coroner that she killed herself with this gunshot, you know?
Right.
It's like, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, I know that this show is kind of built on that and taking yeah. that liberty of, like, there's this guy who's going to be solving these crimes like a cop would, you know,
yeah.
but, you know, with forensic medicine, but this is going just a little too far because he's not even using forensic medicine here in any way, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And the one thing I'll say, though, about this specific episode is there was that one moment in the van where he pulls out the spray bottle of stuff to highlight the blood that could be in the carpet.
Yeah.
And my twisted brain, the first thing it goes to is Dexter. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I know. Where's your black light? No, it doesn't work like that. You know, like.
Yeah. I mean, it does feel in a lot of ways like when I was watching this, I'm sort of like, this is sort of like the prototype for shows like CSI.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Well, there's a little bit, there's definitely CSI in it, but there's a little bit of, I would argue, like House about mm-hmm. this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's not the cantankerous, antisocial guy. You know, he's obviously got a social life and everything, but he's the outcast. He's the guy that tells people what they don't want to hear. And he continually uses, like you said, science to defeat their presumptions about things. And, you know, so I think there are seeds of House. I think there are seeds of CSI. But I don't know if I see anything else besides those two.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, CSI has spawned so many clones, literally, and, you know, I mean, NCIS and everything like that. It's just, I mean.
You know what? That's probably why my brain defaulted and presumed that Quincy was on CBS.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, that's where they all go now. That's where all of the medical crime shows go.
That's true. And it's also CBS has become the network for the network that people's grandparents watch, you know?
The network that I'm terrified of getting into their target demographic because I know it's been a long journey at that point.
Yep. But yeah. So, I mean, that I think to me is the weakest episode of the Taylor episodes from season 8. And next came maybe the most Taylor of them all, which was Quincy's Wedding, which was a two-parter. Taylor wrote both parts, and she actually directed the second part herself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having not been a fan of Quincy for all that long, the wedding episode maybe wasn't as big of a deal to me as it was to some, but I could tell that it was a big deal. It was a two-parter and everything like that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an interesting episode in that it's structured with, like, sort of a, I don't know what would be the B plot or what would be the A plot, but the mystery here is the old guy from Psycho, actually. The guy who plays the cop in Psycho, who's like, his name was Arbogast. They go to his house, you know, and everything.
Yeah.
He dies in a nursing home, and his wife of 65 years admits to killing him. And it's sort of like, you know, mirroring the story of, like, okay, Quincy and Hanover are going to get married, and now here's a couple which has been married for 65 years, and the wife may have killed the husband, and, you know, there's that whole thing.
And by all appearances, they were miserable, because they weren't exactly a loving couple at that 65th wedding anniversary party there.
They reminded me a lot of my grandparents, actually.
I imagine after 65 years, one does get, you know, There are some old grievances that haven't, you know, if they haven't been worked out by that point, they're going to be sore points. They're going to stick around.
Right. And it's almost like kind of shocking when you see them being loving towards each other. And you're like, wait, where did that come from?
Uh-huh.
Because you're just sort of like on each other's case, like nonstop. And it's like, But they do a good job with that here, which is another thing which I kind of wanted to bring up in relation to Taylor's Star Trek work is this show, Quincy, in general, seems to be really good at having characters which are of a certain age, you know? Whereas I know that it's probably not as big of a thing back in 1982 or whatever, but now it's like everything has to be young, young, young. And here's a show which is about like a bunch of like 50-somethings, you know, 40-somethings, 50-somethings. And that's kind of a bold thing to do. I mean, I guess there are shows like that, like CSI and NCIS and everything like that. They tend to have older casts, but, you know, you don't see that too often on TV. And Taylor is actually someone who pushed for that hard in Next Generation. You know, she was the person who said, like, how come all of the extras on the Enterprise are all young? This is supposed to be, like, a job which people make careers out of. How about we get some 60-year-olds on the bridge, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's why you do see older people in, like, the last two seasons of Next Generation just walking around the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of cool, you know? I like that.
I agree with you. You know, and it's, I don't know that anybody, I mean, I CSI didn't start with, you know, an advanced age cast. You know, like they got Ted Danson on there now and, you know, he's obviously a few years on, but when they started, the cast wasn't that advanced in age. They were, you know, late 30s, mid 40s, but they, you know, they had the younger sidekicks off to the side working in the lab, so they had the mix of ages.
Yeah,
I can't see anybody launching a show like this now, where the main character is in his 50s and established and has a life and isn't just breaking into the business or isn't just isn't the Maverick whiz or anything like that. Like, this is just a guy who's made a career and his breadth of knowledge isn't because he's particularly gifted or a genius or anything like that. It's just that he knows his job and he knows what he's talking about. And so the character being this age lets him speak with that authority.
And if you do that, you are going to have someone like William Peterson, who is, you know, an older guy. But then, like you're saying, surround him with like the young techs and stuff like that who are gonna do their thing. And I guess the thing with CSI is it's been on for so many years that now all the young people got old, but that happens.
Watch them grow up in front of our eyes like baby rattlesnakes.
Yes, yes. Now the last episode of the show was also written by Taylor. And that was The Cutting Edge, which involves Barry Newman of, I guess he was in Vanishing Point, right? What I know him from is The Limey.
Yeah.
He played the Peter Fonda's, you know, sort of like agent or whatever in The Limey. He's such a badass in that movie. I'm sorry, that movie's amazing. Anyway, and he's a cutting edge doctor in terms of, I guess, amputees or something. I don't know exactly what it would be.
I don't think that they say it's specifically amputee. Like they have a couple of different procedures. He's it's not Operation Hope. It's Experiment Hope.
Experiment Hope. Yes.
And he's got this group of brilliant physicians and surgeons on his staff that can do, he's trying to push them to do anything. And, you know, he even has like a robotics person on staff who can, you know, can work with, you know, artificial limbs and stuff like that, which leads to some delightful moments of sexual harassment.
That was weird. Yeah.
That's definitely something of its time. You know, I'm pretty sure that nobody in today's environment, with good reason, by the way, I'm not waxing nostalgic for anything like this, but when the one tech or whoever comes up behind the woman who's working on, you know, I guess the arm that's eventually going to become the prototype for the T-800 is sitting there working and he grabs an artificial arm and places on her butt and she jumps and she's like, oh, you, And he's like, oh, I just want to see if you could tell the difference between that and the real thing. I was like, "What? Wow, this is sensibilities have changed over time.
That was really weird. And I was surprised to see that in an episode that Taylor wrote, too, since she is sort of all about gender equality. But maybe, I guess, you know, the thing that they do is, you know, he's like, oh, I just wanted to see if blah, 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 blah. And she's like, yeah, no, just leave. Bye. You know,
right. She does fend him off. Verbally, as it were, she is a strong robot arm tech.
I guess maybe by today's standards, it seems a little weak because today we would expect her to, you know, get the dude fired. But
at a minimum,
her just being able to say like, "Get out of here," you know, "I don't have time for your crap." I guess that's how things went back in the 80s.
Progress for its time.
I guess so. It really does seem like they were setting up a new show. And in fact, I just found some trivia here. This was not only the final episode of Quincy ME, it also served as the pilot of a proposed series entitled The Cutting Edge, with many of the characters that were in this episode. Also, Anita Gillette, who played Quincy's wife, Dr. Emily Hanover, was to have become a regular on this series once Quincy went off the air.
Oh, right, so, because there's that scene where she says she wants the job with the guy.
Right, she's like, yeah, he's like, we need like a psychiatrist, and she's like, this sounds like great work to me. Yeah. And that show, it probably would have been, you know, created by Jerry Taylor, right? I mean, it had to have been. She wrote this episode, she theoretically created Hanover.
Mm-hmm. And it's... Honestly, it was a pretty decent pilot. You know, I do remember partway through wondering when Quincy was going to come back because he's in like the first two scenes and nowhere to be found. Absolutely right. Nowhere to be found until the end.
And basically all of his supporting cast isn't in it and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And I went into this episode thinking like, okay, this is the end of a series which has been on for 8 years. We're going to be wrapping up everything. This is going to be really interesting. This is a really big job for Taylor to have here, to wrap up a show which has been going for like 148 episodes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you watch it and you're like, who are these people? What is going on here? Yeah. And it really does feel like Assignment Earth. I mean, this is totally, you know, mm-hmm. Assignment Quincy. It's not surprising at all to me that that's what they were.
Well, you almost wonder though, if she's producer and they see the writing on the wall and things are coming to a close, is Quincy's wedding really the end of the series in a sense? And the rest is just a denouement as it goes off into this little backdoor pilot. And they were just hoping, okay, we'll start a new show off of this. And maybe even that, I mean, honestly, the way that's set up, is the guy who would have been lead, there were elements of House to him, you know, where he was really driving and alienating people and his wife was estranged and his son had difficulties with it. They set up all of these arcs for the semi antisocial guy who just fought too hard and stuff like that. So yeah, it would have been an interesting show, I think.
It would have been. And also like if Hanover is on that show as a regular, right? I mean, she's married to Quincy. Right. So Quincy's got to show up.
Yeah, a couple of guest appearances.
Every once in a while at least, right?
Sure. Yeah, I need Quincy's help, you know, to figure out how this kid lost his finger or something like that. Yeah.
Or even if his role is just different, where it's like, well, now he's, you know, just like the house husband, essentially, right?
Yeah, you know? Sure.
She is what Hanover was, in a sense, you know?
I will say, though, something very interesting that threw me at first was the guy who plays the heavy in Baby Rattlesnakes,
yes,
plays the heavy in this episode, the guy I always confuse with Carl Reiner, because there is a visual similarity there. And, it jarred me because he walked on and I was like, oh, wow, they're going to find out the guy switched careers or something. And then the guy just looks at Quincy and goes, nice to meet you. I was like, wait, what? No. Like, this isn't like a guy who appeared on a different season or,
right,
you know, Star Trek did that all the time where, you know, how many roles did Mark Lenard and David Warner play over all of the series and movies and everything?
But you put them under different makeup and stuff. Right. And this was almost the same role.
It was almost the same suit. He was pretty much in the same wardrobe.
Yeah, and like when I saw that, I'm like, I was sitting there watching it with my wife, and I'm like, this guy was in the first episode of the series. And I looked it up to make sure I was right. I'm like, no, he was in the first episode of this season, you know?
Right.
He just bookended it with him. And that's crazy. Apparently, I was reading about, like, the Anne Gillette, who played Hanover. I guess she played, earlier in the show, she played Quincy's first wife, who dies of a brain tumor or something like that.
Wow.
Wow. But I guess they figure, whatever, people don't have VCRs, they can't check this stuff, you know?
You know, that's an excellent point, actually. That, you know, yeah, that is an excellent point. I almost wonder, though, like, you look at a show like this, and again, speaking to the era, there seemed to be a much smaller pool of TV actors for primetime dramas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you saw the same people appearing in, you know, just multiple series. It almost seemed like once you broke in, I guess because there were fewer shows to work, there was, much more competitive field. And once you got there, you staked out your territory and your agent just got you on as many roles as they possibly could.
Yeah. And you look at people's credits and they're just, from that era,
mm-hmm.
and they're on every show, you know, hundreds of shows,
right.
just every week on a different show, which
right.
good for them. I mean, the guy who they always talk about is, you know, William Shallert, you know, who was in Trouble with Tribbles and then later in Deep Space Nine. And you can find him on basically every show from that era.
But right.
He was never like a lead.
Well, it's kind of interesting because that sort of mimics live theater, because you'll see, you know, when you go in the programs, the other players, the non-leads, always have these extensive biographies of how many shows they've been on Broadway, and television, it's a teleplay.
Yeah.
And so I think that, with that smaller pool, it makes total sense why everybody was on everything.
Yeah. All right. Well, just one more thing that I want to note here is kind of some of those people who were on it. I mean, there were just one in particular, which really kind of stood out to me, was a Star Trek person. That's William Campbell, who played Koloth mm-hmm. on The Trouble with Tribbles, and then also Trelane in The Squire of Gothos. And he was in the Wedding two-parter as a nursing home executive or whatever. But then also in the very first episode that we watched, Baby Rattlesnakes, the accused is played by a prepubescent Devereaux White, who played Argyle in Die Hard.
I watch him every Christmas.
Me too.
Every single Christmas.
Baby Argyle.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and I couldn't help but, you know, just have in the back of my head, I was like, well, I know he gets a steady job, and this kid works it out for himself.
Right,
he's going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time in a few years.
He's going to be driving a limo and everything like that. Yeah, well, that was pretty cool. All right, any final thoughts on Quincy and Taylor's work on Quincy?
Yeah, her episodes are, you can see the seeds. You can see the beginning of where she's going to go and what she's working with, and sort of the thoughts, the themes that are going to tie her work together over time. And so that's always fun to watch. In terms of Quincy itself, it will always create that warm fuzzy. And it's great they have it streaming on Netflix, but it's an artifact. The show is an artifact.
That's true. That's true. For me, Taylor, I think that this is really interesting how she was kind of able to, even just as sort of a staff writer, although I think she was kind of higher up at this point on the show, she was really able to put her stamp on the series, on a series which had been running, a very formulaic series from what I'm guessing, which had been running for 8 years. And that's really cool. And, you know, I think that it'll be interesting to see what she does on some of these other shows. And also in terms of Quincy, I guess my big takeaway from it and the thing which I was sort of riveted on throughout the series is I wish that I could be as excited about anything as much as Quincy is excited about anything. I mean, like, when someone's talking to him, he is so invested in that conversation, and everything that they say is the most interesting thing he's ever heard in his life. I wish I could be that interested in anything.
Yes.
But maybe one day. Maybe one day. I highly doubt it, though. All right. Before we wrap this up, I do just want to note Glenn A. Larson's contribution to television. He's not a Star Trek creator, but he's someone who I think most Star Trek fans are familiar with in at least small ways. He just passed away this week. He's the creator of Quincy and also Battlestar Galactica, the original. He was the developer on the Buck Rogers show. He also created Knight Rider, which takes place in Star Trek continuity, The Fall Guy, and Magnum P.I., which we'll be covering in a couple weeks.
Yes.
So obviously a huge contribution to the world of television. Battlestar Galactica, I mean, while it doesn't share a lot of similarities to the reboot, it did spawn what I personally think is the best television series of all time. So, you know, you got to give him credit for that. And he wrote this amazing theme song. So,
yeah, I just to speak to the Battlestar Galactica, that is one of those cultural touchstones that anybody who is a sci-fi fan of a certain age, that original series is, it filled a gap because, again, you know, you didn't have Star Wars on videotape.
Yeah.
And Battlestar, that, you know, that's the sign of a pretty slick producer that he's able to say, oh, yes, that I can do that. And we can have a successful show. I mean, it wasn't that successful, unfortunately. But
yeah.
Did he have anything to do with Galactica 1980?
Yeah, he created that too.
Slightly tarnishes his image, in my opinion, then.
He was, I mean, you got to give him credit for just keeping the ship afloat. You know, I mean, that was just sort of like desperation. Like, yes, we will keep Battlestar Galactica on the show for another year, but your budget is $5. So see what you can do, and
fair
that's
enough.
What he did, and
fair
you know
enough.
What can you do? But yeah, so RIP Glenn A. Larson. Anyway.
Maybe he's sitting somewhere with Gene Roddenberry dreaming up the next great sci-fi series in the next plane of existence.
Perhaps. Let's hope so. Well, it's been fun this week talking about Quincy M.E., but this isn't the only thing we're talking about here on Trek FM, so here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
But instead of it being a human being prejudiced against Vulcans because the Romulans look like Vulcans, the Vulcans are taking advantage of themselves looking like Romulans in order to be racist against Romulans.
Earl Grey.
So, what is, so he's got the two armrests, and the right one says little, you know, Ensign, you know, Lamont, and a little arrow. And then the one on the left says Lieutenant Commander Data. Like a little arrow.
The orb.
But when they pull away from that window with Jake and Kira, and they pull away from the station, it's like they're closing the book. They're actually closing the back cover of the book, and it's the end of the story.
To the journey! How do you feel, Char, about the Borg Queen?
Oh boy. I think the longer that I have watched Star Trek, the more I'm in the camp of, I don't know if I like her.
The Ready Room.
They want you to come across on Archer's side where he can be mad at Trip. But I have a really hard time being Archer being mad at Trip because just think of if we still treated, you know, people of a different race like this.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
That could honestly be the reason they brought Wesley, because Wesley's got nothing else going for him there. I mean, yes, he can lead those kids, but that's just going to be by virtue of his age. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, he's 15 years old. Of course, all the other kids are going to look up to him, at least for a while. And then if he ends up being a total tool, then they won't.
Commentary, Trek stars.
Yeah, well, Learning Curve was never meant to be a season one finale. They were going to do the 37s, and then UPN wanted to open season two with it, and that totally didn't work either.
Man, you gotta say UPN really ooped it up.
Literary Treks.
What Jerry Taylor talks about with Catherine Janeway's life is it's kind of a series of her relationships. I mean, she should be doing all sorts of fantastic things, right? And instead, we're learning about her boyfriends.
Melodic Treks.
But there's a whole host of people that appear in Star Trek. As I said, most of it is classical, so it's Verdi, Vivaldi, Strauss, Troisky, Harry Kim.
The 602 Club.
This really does have an impact on, I think, the entire, you know, comic book world. Dark Knight, Dark Knight Returns still have a huge impact in the way that people view Batman today.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 files from our website and grab the RSS link as well. One way that you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you'd like to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact. That'll go straight to us. You can also send us a voicemail. We still haven't gotten any of those voicemails. Come on, guys. You're making us look bad. Just look at the sidebar of the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find us on Twitter at TrekFM. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM, where you'll find the Babel Conference. That's spelled B-A-B-E-L. Just type that into the search engine on Facebook, and it'll pop up. So, John, where can people find you online?
You can find me investigating crimes, using science, on Twitter at Kessel Junkie. KESSELJUNKIE, and a little weekly show called Words with Nerds, prowling around the usual places. A weekly show that I do with my buddy Craig.
Excellent. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, and you can find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where I do Commentary Track Stars Off Topic with Max and our friend Brandon. And you can also find us all, for all practical purposes, on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com if you just want to send us a direct something. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring Commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have the time for. You can even read a book which is based on a teleplay which Glenn Larson is credited for, even if he didn't really write. That's the Battlestar Galactica miniseries, written by Jeffrey A. Carver. It's 5 hours and 2 minutes long. That's like 2 hours longer than the miniseries itself. For 40 years, the 12 colonies of man experienced peace, united since the war against the man-made Cylons. The Cylons, mechanical beings created to perform the manual labor civilization required, were gone forever. Or so humanity thought.
Dun, dun, dun.
And since you listen to Trek FM, you can get this book for free. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. Well, that's about it for Jerry Taylor's work on Quincy M.E., and we will be back next week to discuss her work on Blue Thunder. Hello and welcome to... Oh, shit. I'm already... Okay. All right. Sorry.
Sorry. Clear the mechanism.
That's from For Love of the Game.
The best baseball movie ever made.
This is what I've been saying for the past 15 years.
Absolutely.
Well, until Moneyball came out.
That movie is Moneyball.
Freaking amazing. You haven't seen Moneyball?
No.
Oh, check out Moneyball. It's amazing.
Okay. All right.
But For Love of the Game, yes, I totally agree with you. Up until 2011, it was the best baseball movie ever made. That thing's... And Sam Raimi's best movie, too.
Totally agree. He had...
Thank you.
High five? Yeah, high five.
All right.
Yep. He had complete control of every one of his faculties in that one.
Yes, I agree. Man, I'm sticking this somewhere in something. Because finally, 15 years for someone to agree with me, but all right.
You've been wandering in the desert.
Okay, anyway, all right. Where were we at?